Hi.
Welcome back to Plenty Plenty Zuzu. I'm Steph.
And I'm Connor. And we are the co-host of this podcast where each week we help build our hypothetical zoo slash botanical garden. So each week I will add a species of animal.
And I add a species of plant.
And it's been a little while since we released an episode. It's been just over 2 months now. I think the last one we put out was on the 1st of Feb. So we've been away for quite a long time, but we have had a very, very good and very exciting reason for this little hiatus.
We have. We did a whole proper live show, like a proper big stage. There were 750-ish people. And yeah, it was amazing.
Yeah, so we were on stage as part of an event called An Evening of Unnecessary Detail, run by the Festival of the Spoken Nerd. So we were on stage with some amazing science communicators that I've looked up to, who I've been to events with and kind of just kept an eye on Twitter for ages, and podcasters that I really love, authors that have put amazing work out. So it was a huge, huge, amazing lineup of brilliant people. And then us.
The very best of them. No, they found us via our podcast. And yeah, we got to go on stage and do a whole show about plants and animals and the interconnectedness of nature, which got loads of big laughs, big clap for my bad drawing of a leaf. And yeah, we had loads of people come up in the interval and at the end of the show, just literally one after the other saying like, that was really good, we really liked it. Like, I know we're bragging right now, but honestly... It was great. Like, it really was. That was what happened. It was just so wonderful.
It was really fun. And it felt like a really big opportunity for us and like a really big moment in the podcast, because it was only, we did this in March. And so it was only a year since the podcast actually got started. And we were already there on the main stage of the Bristol Beacon. The first time I've actually been back in the Bristol Beacon since it reopened after its 7 year or whatever long refurbishment. And we were behind stage with a green room.
Yeah.
It was absolutely brilliant. So... just another shout out to Helen, Matt and Steve from Festival of the Spoken Nerd for getting us involved and giving us the platform, because it felt like quite a big moment for the podcast, didn't it?
It really did. And I think it's one of those things you don't quite know that you can do it until you're doing it.
Oh, yeah.
Like when we walked out onto the stage and everyone's clapping, we'd just been announced. So I was like, I have absolutely no idea what's going to come out of my face. Like, I don't know. But then we did it and we did it well. And yeah, and I just really value as well everyone that's followed us on social media or given us a review and a listen on Spotify. Like, it's been so lovely to see the numbers go like, boop, 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 like from the show. And yeah, we just had the best time. So that's why we had a break. Basically, all the time we were putting into our podcast then got shifted to putting it into the show so that we didn't get on stage and do something weird and rubbish. But now we're back and we feel more organized than ever. We have big plans, basically.
Yeah, absolutely. And keep an eye out on the episodes we release, because all of those people that we were on stage with, we are forcing to come on the podcast. So we'll hopefully have some of those as guests in future.
As well as someone we've outright begged, and I cannot wait to announce who they are. But it's a secret in case they say no between now and then.
Yes, yes, but we have got some excellent guests lined up. So yeah, it's going to be really, really fun. But yeah, that's kind of why we've been away. But that was only the start of my really big week, because straight after our performance at the Bristol Beacon, I went for 4 nights of performances in my local panto. So I played a very, very, very camp pirate called Soft Furnishings in the Hotwells pantomime production of Treasure Island.
It was amazing.
It was absolutely mad. It was madness. It was brilliant. It was so much fun. It's a panto that's been running for 42 years with just a group of local people all getting together doing panto in March because everyone's busy in December. And it was just really, really fun. It's something I've wanted to do for absolutely ages. I always go to panto, usually with your mum.
Yep.
And we sit in the audience and go, oh, it'd be so much fun to do panto. And I go, yeah, I really want to be a dame. And your mum goes, yeah, I could see you being a dame, to be fair. And then I saw this come up and went, sod it, let's go and try and be the dame.
I really admire that so much, that you were like, I want to do this thing. Oh, look, the opportunity to do this thing. I'm just going to go do this thing.
Yeah, and considering, I mean, we might have spoken about this on the podcast before, but I was a proper nerdy, like, awkward little kid.
No, shut up. You?
I resent that. And I mean, my family will tell you that I never used to be able to go into a cinema and buy my own cinema ticket. Like, I was so totally couldn't talk to anybody. So, I mean, the fact that I'm like a communicator for my job, but the fact that in 1 week I went on stage in front of 750 people and then did 4 days panto. I worked it out. I think I collectively across the whole week there was like over 1,500 people in audience for productions I was on stage for, which that's is quite
the
really
number
cool.
of people, the number of eyes you've had on you.
Yeah, 3,000.
Yeah. So many. But no, the panto was great. You played like a very camp pirate and you were fantastic. Like, I know I've got like a really strong bias, but I thought you were like the absolute best. You were so funny. And like whenever you said any line, the whole audience was laughing and I was there like filming. Like, oh, he's so good.
Honestly, you were like Amy Poehler in Mean Girls.
I was exactly like that. I was really unashamedly like just filming everyone you said. It's really bad. But it was so fun. And we had all our friends there. And yeah, I was so proud of you and your sparkly pink gear. It was just so perfect.
No, it was a very big week, a very busy week. Mm. And so we've had to take a few weeks to recover, hence why we're recording now. But we are back. We're going to hopefully make things bigger, better than ever. But as always, we appreciate any feedback. So if you listen to this and go, oh, I think this would be really cool, or actually, I know somebody that would be really, really good for the podcast, please do let us know. Please get in touch on any of our social medias. We'll drop them at the end of the episode because we really love to hear it and we want to make sure this podcast is something big and it can be a real community and we get a nice group of people listening that are getting what they want out of the podcast. So yeah. If you have anything you think is missing, let us know. We'll try and put it in. We'll try and include it.
Yeah.
Shall we get started? Because I think, yes. Is it your turn to go first this week?
It is.
So everyone, you can just fast forward the next 20 minutes and listen to my really important bit later.
Ew. Doubt it. So now remember the rule, you can't look at my laptop screen.
Yes, sorry, otherwise, I can't.
I get really aggy about it.
You get really aggy about
stop
it.
Stop ruining my words.
No, you're getting like, aggy?
This is because I went, no, you're a nerd.
Yeah.
I live in a house with you that is, I'm going to say, close to 200 bits of animal memorabilia.
Should we talk about your plants? Should we talk about your plants?
Shall we? Oh my god, we got a free god. Monstera off of Facebook Marketplace.
We actually should, hang on. We totally should.
So I was at home scrolling on Facebook Marketplace. Suddenly I was confronted with this enormous Monstera and it was like free to a good home. And I was like, I'm a good home. And so I messaged the woman and was like, please, may I have your plant? And I was like, I've got like 60 plants, but I don't have a big Monstera. I would love to have it, blah, blah. And she was like, yeah, all right. I was like, oh my god, I can't believe that timing worked out. And then I had to break the news I didn't have a car because she was like, come pick it up whenever. And I was like, that's so funny. No. How about you come to me to give me my free plant? And
she did.
Yeah, I gave her, like, she offered all this and I gave her money for petrol, but it was really kind. And then when we were messaging and she was like on her way, she's like, I've actually got some other house plants I don't really want. Do you want them as well? And I was like, yeah, of course I do. And so she gave me like three others. And then our friend Lorna is moving to Edinburgh.
Boo.
But that means we've got her plants. And then we went plant shopping as well for some reason. So in a week, we got like 10
plants. New plants. So the Monstera was news to me. I got home from work and I kid you not, I walked into the hall and Steph greeted me immediately, which was ominous enough. And just, I genuinely didn't know what to expect because she greeted me in the hall and went, before you go into the lounge, please just remember that you love me. I thought she'd killed a man. I want to say, I didn't freak out at all. And I...
What did you say, though?
I said that loving you is a challenge, but I said it's a challenge that I'm up to.
You did.
Can we get a collective R, please?
And then you ordered a big plant pot for it.
See? And he looks gorgeous now.
You can't see, but he looks great. I love it.
Right, so yes. Now that we're going from talking plants, let's talk more plants.
Frick yeah.
Seamless segue.
So my approach to this, I was like, no preconceptions. I've got nothing jumping out at me that I want to do. I'm just going to do a bunch of Googling, a bunch of research and see what stands out to me. And then I found something that did just that. However, it's very underwhelming to look at, is all I'll say. But very interesting. So I'm taking you on a journey. Not under the sea.
No, that was like a... Yeah, okay, you can do it better. Right, move on.
We are going to our neighbouring country, Wales. So there...
It was Wales. Like a whale song.
But they also don't sound like that. That was a pigeon noise. So, we're in Wales. Imagine you're a bird.
Caw-caw!
Flying over this beautiful limestone headland that seems to weave itself in a wiggly shape. It's on the north coast of Wales. It's very rocky. It's got rocks dating back 339 to 326 million years. Thing is, with those rocky numbers, yeah, but the thing with those numbers is they don't mean anything. I was like, oh my God, but then like, I don't know how far like the gravel outside goes back to, you know what I mean? 500 years? I don't know. Anyway, so this place, I really want to go there. They have trams.
Oh, okay.
And a cable car.
Okay, so this ulterior, you basically Googled plants around trams. And were like, sick.
I realised earlier today, slight segue, that...
another mode of transport?
Yeah, I've never been on that one either. But my point is that I realised the reason why... Because I've been getting confused as an adult where people are like, well, you really love transport, like you're really into transport. Because I've never really thought that about myself. And then I realised it's because I just assumed we all were. Like, it's really cool. Your body is not moving, but you're moving because something's moving you. That's incredible. Like, the engineering, the different types.
It's cool.
Like,
no, it is.
If
it
you're
is.
On, like, a horse, it's different because the horse is walking, so it's, like, not as interesting. It just sat on someone else walking, basically. But if you're on, like, a tram or a steam train especially, look, you're telling me water is making me go at 30 miles an hour. 40, like, it's amazing. It's amazing. So, yeah, I did have that realisation today. I thought I'd show you. So, this place that I speak of, it is called Egogarth in Welsh.
Egogarth.
And I practice that a lot with a man on YouTube. Bet.
What did that mean? What does it mean?
It means Great Orm, which you might have heard of.
Ooh, I have heard.
Yeah, so Great Orm is this place. It's north of Wales. The English name Great Orm comes from the Old Norse word for sea serpent. So, you know, I said it's like looks a little bit wiggly. It's yeah. So there's thoughts that Vikings. There's evidence that Vikings raided the area, but they didn't ever leave like written records or anything. But because it comes from Old Norse, they think the Vikings were like, oh my God, it looks like a snake. It's called snake. And yeah, so the plant is called. Okay, I couldn't find a pronunciation for this online, so I'm just going to have a stab at it. Craigathal Egogarth, which translates to rock apple of Gogarth.
That's really fun.
Right? The scientific name is Cotton Easter Cambricus. I thought
Cotton Easter?
Yeah.
I've seen a lot of recently about Cotton Easter. I don't know what.
Oh, I bet you have. I bet you have. So, first of all, Cotton Easter I thought was a good genus to choose because what is it in 2 days? Regular Easter. So, theme. If I'd really thought about having a theme, I probably would have chosen something better. But and I was like, ah, Easter.
Okay.
So, cotton Easters, they're a genus of flowering plants in the rose family.
Ooh.
So, you might have noticed the name, Craigathal Egogarth, has Gogarth in it, which we know is Great Orm. So, what does that suggest?
Do you find it at Great Orm?
And where else?
Only there.
Yeah.
Ah.
In this one place.
It's now, endemic.
Yeah, it's endemic. And not only that, it's the only species of cotton Easter that's native to the British Isles. And Egogarth is only 2 miles long and 1 mile wide.
So cotton Easter, the only native one, is only found on this strip?
Yeah.
That's it?
Yeah.
Damn.
And it's endemic, so there's nowhere else you can see it. It's just there in the wild. So this plant, it thrives in rocky habitats, clings onto the cliffs. And
rocky habitats?
Yeah.
It's the... Eye of the tiger, it's a
Did
thriller.
The audience appreciate that joke? Write in to Connor's DMs and slag him off.
This is actually why I've not recorded for 2 months. It's because I can't stand Stephanie.
And yet you stick around, that's all I need. So a lot of this 2 mile by 1 mile area is a special area of conservation. It's a site of special scientific interest. And a heritage coast, because it's so important for wildlife, archaeology, landscape. Not because of trams, but the trams look really good. Its common name is Welsh Cotton Easter. It's English common name. And because I don't know how Craigathal Egogarth is actually pronounced, I think I'm going to use the Welsh Cotton Easter name. It's a low-growing evergreen shrub. It reaches up to about 3 feet tall. So not huge. It's got these gorgeous leaves. They're my favourite bit. It's like dark and glossy on top. Nice and soft and light underneath, and it can get berries which can be red, purple, or black. So here's a lovely picture, and you can see it's almost got this rim of like shiny silver.
Oh.
And it's just because it's...
I thought those were white flowers. That's just a rock in the background.
That's a rock in the background. Oh, okay. But it's...
Oh, look at the berries.
Yeah, the berries are bright red. And But to take you back to the leaves for a second. Look at that. They're so like...
Are they fuzzy?
Yeah, underneath. They're like all light. You can see that there. It's all light. And yeah, I love it. I think it's great. So it's a very attractive plant. But I think it's one that if you saw it, you maybe wouldn't give it a second look.
Mm-hmm.
And you would be a fool, and here's why. It's critically endangered.
Of course it is. It's found on a patch of coast that's 2 miles long and 1 mile wide.
Yeah, it doesn't come as a shock, does it?
No.
But it actually used to be very widespread in the 18th century. But a lot of plants, part of the reason their numbers have declined throughout the UK, a lot of wild plants, is because they were harvested, over-collected for mm-hmm. ornamental gardens, flower markets, all of that. Snakehead fritillaries are one. They're just decimated. Like, lots of them are. All of our native orchids, basically.
Yeah.
So that was one of it in the 18th century. But also, in more recent decades, it's been overgrazing from sheep, goats, and cows.
Oh, okay.
I went down a little bit of a rabbit hole with the goats. Do you remember, during the beginning of the pandemic, there was this news story of, like, the goats in this Welsh town.
Yes!
That's that... the town.
Oh, my gosh!
Yeah. So there was this news story... In case you didn't hear it, at the beginning of 2020, when everyone was like, oh my God, nature is healing. All the animals are like hanging out in towns and stuff. And then it actually turned out they weren't actually doing it more than usual. And it's a whole thing. But anyway, one was there were these goats in Great Orme that were just wandering this town. Now, I looked up the pronunciation for the town. It's got a sound in it. So I'm not going to be able to do that.
Yep, that's fair.
But it's really cool. These goats, they have like 200 of them, Kashmir goats. And they were a gift from a ruler of another country to one of the queens. And it's this one herd and they've just stayed. There's about 200 of them. And yeah, they just hang out in Great Orme and wandered into the town during lockdown being like, where's all the people? But they've been overgrazing this plant.
Oh no.
So it not only obviously kills seedlings, just tears mm-hmm. them up, but it also stops the biggest ones from getting bigger.
Yes.
So the plant's average plant size has gone down as well. Now, the reason I think that you'll have heard of them is because of your one true love,
yes.
Chester Zoo.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. That is what they have done, a load of like captive growing and have basically reintroduced it to coastline.
Yeah.
Yes, of course.
So these numbers got as low as 6 individuals.
Mm.
I think that was a few decades ago. And then loads of different organisations, universities, gardens, NGOs, charities like Chester Zoo, mm-hmm. all got together and they started this like decades long programme of it being one of the species that they were trying to reintroduce and everything. And so this very month, specimens that they had taken like essentially clippings of and grown them in the captivity basically, and you know it takes a while when you take a wild plant and you're trying to grow them out of their wild habitat, it takes a little while to work out ideal growing situations for them, ideal yeah. conditions. So they've been trying for a really long time and they finally got these plants established and they've reintroduced 30 new individuals. And they've done it in a secret site because it's, you know, you don't want people to go rip them up or anything like that. So they've done it in a secret site. They've put up, it looks like, defences from grazing animals, so they should be okay. And so now there's 110 individuals in the wild.
Whoa.
Isn't that cool? So, yeah, I thought it was amazing because it's actually a zoo that's headed it mm-hmm. up. Chester Zoo have led it. And yeah, other organisations that were involved with Plant Life, Bengal University. Yeah, it's just been wonderful. So they had loads of volunteers go out and it's really helped like re-establish this plant in the wild. So yeah, that's basically the main reason. The article on Chester Zoo about it came out 24 hours ago. But I just thought that was so wonderful, and to see a zoo head it up.
Yeah, totally. Just to shout out Chester Zoo, they have got a really, really good plant team, and they have got, I think they hold 6 nationally important plant collections. They've got loads of different Nepenthes species, loads of different orchids. They've got an absolutely amazing plant and botanical team that look after some incredibly rare specimens. They are absolutely fantastic.
Yeah, it's his one true love, like I said. But yeah, so that's basically it. I just wanted to shout out about that. And I love that for Planty Planty Zuzu. That's a proper Planty Planty Zuzu crossover.
Yeah.
So in terms of the one and only Planty Planty Zuzu hypothetical zoo and botanical gardens, how would we show it off? How would we engage people with it? So I would like a native species section, because as lots of like us environmentally nature-y types will often say. I think a lot of people I know that got into nature, you sort of left the UK because you're like, oh, there's no nature here. And then you go away and you see all this other nature, and then you come back to UK and you're like, oh, there's loads of nature here. It's different to that other place that I've just been in. But we are heavily nature depleted, like really low on the biodiversity. Like the amount we lost is terrible. But it's so, it gives you so much hope to see all these efforts go on, and the amount of coordination and time and effort that's gone in to make it happen just fills me with joy and hope and things. So we should definitely have a native species area. And this can be one of the first. And then I was deciding how to show it off, and I was like, we'll simply build a headland. It's an imaginary zoo.
We can have those coastal birds.
You know what? Yeah, we can have coastal birds, but you know what else we can have? Vikings raiding it. We could have, we could hire people to be Vikings raiding that. Wait, no, that might be traumatizing. No, enough time has passed that it won't be traumatizing. No one's traumatized by Vikings anymore, are they?
No, I doubt anyone's traumatized by Vikings these days. No,
I'm certain.
It's probably safe.
I also thought cliff diving. So we could have a situation where it's a headland, but like a miniature version. And we have that plant there being shown off. It's probably some like good interp that you can do to do with the plants. But we could also just, you could jump off it into body of water, which then got me thinking, you know how some of your enclosures, I know the sunfish was definitely one, where it's got like an open top. And I've asked before, can people swim with it? And you've been like, no, that's unethical. However, what if we built a swimming pool made out of glass, like by the, at the top of one of these like open top aquarium thing, and then you can swim around with the fish while being separate from them, but you can like dive and look at them through like a snorkel. You're not allowed to say no because it's my imaginary zoo and botanical gardens as well. Yeah, it's all part of Plant of Plenty Zuzu's commitment to rewilding. And you know what I would really love is to have a section at Plant of Plenty Zuzu which we are rewilding with native species, so people, visitors can come and help us plant or help us sow
hypothetical
seeds.
Rewilding with hypothetical native species.
Exactly. I can't wait till we've got a hypothetical native species team when we interview more people. So yeah, that's it.
That sounds amazing. If anyone wants to come on the podcast and interview to be a Viking raider, let us know.
That'd be great.
But no, that sounds absolutely brilliant. I really like that idea of be like, I don't know how we'd show it off, so let's just build a headland. Let's do that. Yeah, great.
Birds will fly around it.
But yeah, cotton Easter, I also think, the red berries remind me, I think cotton Easter is quite a popular plant along with rowan for waxwings when they visit. So this year we had a really big eruption of waxwings. In the UK, that migrate over to the UK from Scandinavia. And so I think cotton Easter is quite a big plant that they like to eat. They enjoy the red berries, I believe.
Nice. Well, that's me done. So now we move into the far inferior animal section of the podcast.
Woo!
Inferiority!
Fly on the flag for inferiority. Connor Davis since 1998.
He's inferior. Inferior.
Right, well, it's my turn. So let's get started. Now, it's really funny that you added a native species because I'm also adding a native species this week.
Are you?
No.
Oh. I'm sorry you're not as good as me.
No, not in the slightest. Mine's from Asia. I had a look through at what I'd already added, and unfortunately, I was showing a huge bias in the taxonomy. I was showing a huge bias in the animals I was adding. And there was lots of mammals and lots of birds. So we're going to go for some of the less feathery, less furry guys. So we're going for an ophidian.
Ooh.
Well, what do you think an ophidian is?
When you said it, I was like, maybe it's like an elm? No. You know the things in the cave that you did?
An olm. I did think, when you said the great orm is snake-like, is olm close to snake? Because it looks snaky. I don't know.
It's all coming together.
An olm's an amphibian. It's not an amphibian.
So it's not an ophidian.
An olm's not an ophidian, no.
I don't know what an ophidian is.
Well, it does actually quite link to what you were saying about the place earlier.
See, snake.
Snake.
Snake. They're called ophidians.
Yeah, a snake is an ophidian.
Oh, wow, I didn't know that. Like the same way a frog's an amphibian.
No, not quite in that. A snake is a reptile, but under reptile is ophidian, so I think it's a clade.
Oh, okay.
So yeah, we're going reptile, and then you're in the squamates,
okay,
which is the order. And under your order, you've got the clade, which is ophidia. So it's an ophidian. So, name me a snake.
Carpet python.
Oh, no.
Adder.
No. I call it top four snakes you think of when you think of a snake.
Black mamba.
No. It's top four snakes you think of if you're in a year four class and I ask you, hey, what snake is this?
Cobra.
It's a cobra. What cobras do you know?
I don't know if I know any cobras outside of the name cobra.
It's a class of royalty.
King cobra.
Yes.
No, oh, okay, I do know some cobras. I was lying.
Yeah, we're adding the king cobra this week. It's really funny, actually, in that you've chosen Welsh Cockatoos because Chester Zoo did it. Because I've chosen King Cobra because there's been loads of news recently this week about London Zoo's opening their new reptile house.
Ooh.
Which has got a king cobra in that we've seen before. Now, immediately, I've got a disclaimer.
Ooh, okay.
In that a king cobra is not actually a true cobra.
Why?
Because they are in a completely different genus. True cobras are the Naja genus, but the king cobra is Ophiophagus genus.
God, that's a gorgeous name.
But actually, there are seven more genera of snakes with common names that include cobra that aren't in the Naja genus. So there are actually loads and loads of snakes that we call cobras that aren't technically cobras. And I looked into it, and it all looks quite in-depth and detailed, but there's a lot of genetic analysis that shows king cobras are different to actual true cobras, and they're actually an early offshoot of this genetic lineage that gives black mambas.
Excellent. I named his cousin.
Yeah, pretty much. A couple of differences between them and true cobras. Their defence is they raise this hood, so as they stand up, they kind of, I say stand up, they don't have any legs, but as they raise the top, the front half of their body up, they extend this big hood.
Yes.
I mean, it makes them look bigger, more impressive. In true cobras, that's much wider. It's quite narrow in a king cobra. It also is different colours, so it tends to be stripy, but could also just be black or tan, and it doesn't have any markings on the back of its hood. It has the usual stripe across the whole of its body, whereas other cobras, true cobras especially, tend to have eye markings on the back. If you remember, we had a snake skin at Bristol Zoo that had eye markings on the back that we used for the meerkat talk.
Oh, yeah.
And it has, like, these eyes on the back that makes it look like something behind it is being watched, so it helps it keep it safe from predators. So it doesn't have that. And then to get really detailed, they've got 11 scales on the head, a king cobra, rather than 9 on the scales of a true cobra.
I love the idea of someone getting up close and being like, 1,
yeah,
2.
Yeah, I don't know how useful that's going to be if you've been bitten by a cobra and you're like, is it a king or is it not?
I got to 8 and then it wiggled away.
Yeah. But yeah, the king cobra, absolutely amazing. World's longest venomous snake.
Wow.
So, yeah, they are very impressive. They can get up to about 5.5 meters long.
That's much like me. Wait, no, that's taller than me. So I'm 5.5 feet.
Also different from true cobras, in that when they raise this hood and they defend themselves, they hiss. Their hiss comes at such a frequency that it sounds like a growl. So it's a lot deeper than a true cobra's hiss. It can also still move forward while it raises its body to strike. So it often strikes forward and upwards at the same time. And it can make it really hard to judge the safe zone. So it can be quite dangerous getting close to a king cobra because you can't always tell how far that snake is actually going to be able to strike. And it can deliver multiple bites in a single attack. But actually, saying that, it's a lot less aggy than other cobras. If it sees danger, it tends to flee rather than standing and defending itself and fighting. It tends to flee. The most aggressive it gets is during the breeding season, and when it breeds with females, it will fight off other males. So they effectively wrestle each other and try and pin each other on the ground. But it's because they don't have any arms, it's just them using that. It's them whacking their heads together and trying to pin each other. It sounds really funny. It's the only snake in the world that actually will lay eggs in a nest. It builds a nest above ground and lays eggs in it, usually made of dry leaves and things like that, located at the base of a tree, and they can lay up to 50 eggs in there at one time.
50?
Yeah. Oh,
imagine coming across that and there's just 50 snakes.
Yeah, and each of those snakes out in the wild could live up to around 20.
Oh, wow.
Mm.
So they're doing quite well out in the wild. Am I skipping ahead?
We'll come on to that. So it's widely distributed around Asia, so across the Indian subcontinent, through Southeastern Asia, Southern China. So it's got quite a wide range, but it's not often seen because it's quite elusive in amongst dense forests, but also kind of shrubland, mangrove forest as well. So there's lots of diversity in the habitat it lives in, and actually there's quite a lot of diversity in the coloration because of that habitat. So you will get some striped, you will get some that are more of a tan color, more of an olive color, more of a black color, depending on those habitats they live in. Now, what does a king cobra eat?
Rats.
The clue is in their name. Ophiophagus.
Snakes.
Their name in Greek means snake eater.
They eat other snakes?
Mmm.
Gross.
They eat other snakes, including cannibals. Other king cobras.
Cannibals.
Yeah, they will literally eat each other.
Wow.
Sometimes lizards as well, but mainly snakes. And they basically, if they eat a big one, they can live for 7 months without eating again because they've got a really slow metabolism. But yeah, their diet is mainly snakes.
How do they eat the skeleton?
They eat it whole. They swallow all of the prey whole.
So at some point, they might have two skeletons in them.
Oh, wow.
Right?
Well, not at some point. Any time they eat.
Yeah, they'd have, like, if they ate one that's roughly the same size as them, they'd be very reinforced. Yeah. Bulletproof.
Like a double bag, bing bag.
Yeah, they'd be able to, like, go on the tip of the tail and just, like, bounce along because they have so much structure. But all right. 5.5 meters tall. Oh, my God. Terrifying.
Oh my god, if a snake could walk, it would be like 3 times the height of me.
That'd be so scary. They'd be like alien movies.
If you stood a king cobra on its tail, it's taller than a giraffe.
That's so
Whoa.
Tall.
Whoa. Well, it's taller than most giraffes.
Well, yeah.
World record holder was 5.75 metres for a giraffe.
But that's scary, isn't it?
That is terrifying, isn't it? Going from terrifying to terrifying.
Yeah.
Venom.
Yeah.
They have got venom. They can kill people in as little as 30 minutes following a bite.
Oh, no.
So, yeah, they have got a lot of venom. But actually, not many people die from king cobras because they've developed basically a really good anti-venom and that's stopped quite well. And so, actually, it's not that much of a drama, their venom. I think it's...
They're probably quite recognisable as well, so you can go to the hospital and be like, yeah, it was a king cobra.
Yeah, I think they release slightly less venom and it's slightly less intense. There are other cobras that are more deadly and their venom is more of an issue.
Okay.
And especially things like black mambas as well. Again, much more of an issue. I think these guys are deadly and people do die from them, but not as much as they once did and not as much as other cobras. But they have got a really, really important role in cultures. They are recognised as having some kind of deity-like position or kind of religious significance in Hinduism, in Buddhism as well. So there's kind of lots of significance in different cultures put on them through Thailand, through India, Vietnam, places like this. But there is one specific clan called the Snake Clan in Pakokku in Burma. That they held a really, really significant place for because they help, well, keep them safe effectively because they use protection tattoos. Mm. So they mix a tattoo ink with snake venom from king cobras.
That's so clever.
So they're Buddhist and they're Buddhist snake handlers. And so they've tattooed their bodies for centuries to protect themselves against vipers and cobras. They tattoo themselves with cobra ink on the upper halves of their body and viper ink on the lower half. And there's currently about a dozen members of this clan. And they claim that no member has ever been killed by a snake. And these people are responsible for, in the villages around where they live, removing snakes that are dangerous that come in. So to have no members ever killed is absolutely amazing.
Yeah. Wow.
So they undergo weekly tattooing. Part of a ritual that involves prayer, a very large metal needle, and black ink mixed with the venom from these snakes.
So does it actually make pictures on them, like tattoo pictures?
Yeah, so it's usually Buddhist symbols.
So they just go over them like every week?
I believe so. I don't know how big they do them, so I don't know if it's a new one every week or if they go over them or what.
I have so many questions. We need to go say hi.
No, I don't know the science behind that, if that actually does work, almost like microdosing, isn't it?
I guess that's where my head went. It's that thing of like slightly infecting yourself, you know, when people used to have measles parties or whatever.
Yeah, so I don't know if the science is actually on their side or if it's just a belief that this will happen, but...
Either is fine. Imagine being so cool that you're like the guy that goes out to remove the snakes and you'd arrive with all your tattoos... And people are like, oh, thank God, they're here to remove the snake. Yeah. And you'd be like, yeah, of course I am. And you just... Because it could be that it does do the thing with the anti-venom, or it could be that it's like that confidence in handling the snakes. You know you'll be okay, so then the snake is calmer. You know how the snakes will get tense if you were tense when you're holding them. Oh, that's so interesting.
So you asked earlier if they're doing okay. Mm. They are not.
Oh,
they are considered vulnerable. So again, things like habitat loss, taking specimens from the wild, harvesting for skin, traditional medicine, and persecution is another big one of the animals out in the wild. So they've got a lot of fear around them with good reason. Mm. Well, not really with good reason, but it makes sense that you'd be scared of something that is venomous, but actually the evidence isn't that they're really, really dangerous and they're going to kill loads of people. It's that you can live with them fairly happily. But they are protected in quite a few different countries. So in China, the Philippines, India, Vietnam, they've all got fairly high levels of protection. They are protected from another cultural tradition, snake charming, that basically started in India. King cobras were used every now and then. They mainly use spectacled cobras now, but it is technically illegal to be doing that. Snake charming is illegal in India as of 1972, the Wildlife Protection Act.
Is that because of like animal abuse, I'm guessing?
Yeah, it's animal welfare issues. With snake charming, I think a lot of it involved defanging snakes to make sure they were less dangerous, but also the way that they were kept as well. But it is technically illegal in India, so I think it still does happen, but it shouldn't be. And I had a look at conservation projects for them as well and found the Agumbe Rainforest Research Station. That's in the Western Ghats in India, so southern India. They tend to have a two-pronged approach, so there's lots of education of local people about how to deal with snakes. They see them, how to safely remove them, how to deal with any snake bites that do happen, and anti-venom and things like that, but mainly educating people to not be afraid of snakes and to make sure they're given them a wide berth, they're relocating them if they can do so safely, and yeah, what they can do when they see a snake to avoid getting bitten. But they also a really cool project they started in 2008 called the King Cobra Telemetry Project, which was putting wildlife trackers into them, so these little chips that could track them, and using telemetry to track the individuals to see how far they move, understand their behaviors, because they'll travel through different territories, especially the males will, to find females. And so it can help map these populations across the regions, see how much they're moving, will learn about their behaviours, basically to inform their conservation strategy plan and see if the efforts are working or not, if those numbers are going up, if those numbers are going down. So they collected a load of data on this. Recent projects also involve documenting snake perceptions from locals in and around the region, again, with this kind of community engagement and researching what people think of snakes that they might share their areas with, and monitoring king cobra nests and the movement of females to and from the nest as well, again, just to understand a bit more behaviour. So they're doing some really, really useful stuff out there. And all of those cobras that they tagged and released were rescues that they brought in that may have been injured after being found in villages or towns, or may have been removed from villages or towns and kind of looked after for a while there and re-released. So they've been doing some absolutely amazing stuff for king cobras. So, king cobras in zoos. As I mentioned, there is only one king cobra in the UK, and he is down at the ZSL, London Zoo. In a brand new purpose-built enclosure now, in their new Secret Life of Reptiles and Amphibians building that they've literally opened today.
We need to see it.
On the date of recording, yes, we do, absolutely. So they've just built this brand new purpose-built reptile house to replace their absolutely lovely, gorgeous old reptile house that, as with many of the old listed buildings at the London Zoo, wasn't fit for purpose for keeping very niche animals that need very specific conditions in anymore, unfortunately. So ZSL has got a really interesting history with king cobra, in that they were, from what I can see, potentially one of the first zoos in the UK to have king cobras and to actually import them in from the wild, as zoos used to do. And actually, that king cobra was a world record holder.
Oh, wow.
A king cobra that was captured in April 1937 near Port Dickson in Malaysia had attained a length of 5.71 metres by autumn 1939, which makes it the world record holder for longest venomous snake.
Oh my God. I guess it's probably a combination of its genetics, but also the fact that it would have just had exactly the food it needed. That's amazing.
It did, however, come to a fairly sad end, because what happened in 1939?
The Nazis?
Yeah, the war.
Yeah.
So, like any other animal that they had on site that was venomous, they had to be put to sleep to avoid any venomous animals escaping the zoo site if they were bombed.
My God, those poor keepers. Can you imagine?
Yeah. I mean, lots of zoos around the UK had to do it.
That's all. I literally didn't know that. I'd never thought about that. What about animals like lions, where it's like, oh, they can
get out? Some of them were moved. Some of them would have been killed. So, for example, I know Bristol Zoo, around the war as well, some of the seals were released back into the Bristol Channel. I think there was jaguars that we sent up to Chester Zoo to avoid them escaping. Yeah, exactly, where it was less likely to be bombed, because London and Bristol, I mean London especially, very, very likely target for bombing. So the risk is incredibly high. There's actually a really interesting article on ZSL's website about how it fared in the war. It says all the venomous animals were killed to remove the possibility of them escaping, but they were able to save some reptiles, Komodo dragons, Chinese alligators, by basically popping them in large boxes and kind of keeping them a bit more safe.
I saw they sent some animals to Whipsnade as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Again, their site outside of the city. In terms of other zoos, there are about 100 king cobras in captivity in zoos around the world. So a few in Europe, quite a lot in Asia, and quite a lot in North America as well. So places like San Diego, Denver have looked after them as well. They're a fairly common one, which brings us on to how I want to show it off in Planty Planty Zuzu. It's been a little while since we've revisited it, but how would you feel about popping a little bit of animal goodness in your natural selection garden?
Yes. Oh, no one's going to make it out alive.
Now, he's going to be in a big viv, so he's going to have a purpose-built vivarium that's really, really big. It's jungly themed. It can go in with... I was having a look. I don't think we've added any Asian plants that could kill you. So we're going to have to get some more of those in.
Yeah.
But yeah, I want to have a whole venom section of the garden. Perfect. I want king cobras. I want venom and poison. So I want poison dart frogs. I want king cobras. I want other venomous snakes. And I want
lionfish.
Yeah, lionfish. Even like slow loris.
Ooh, that would be cool.
Only venomous primate. So yeah, I want a whole poisonous venomous animal section as well. And I want to talk about, I want some really interesting interp about actually how much venom they hold, how rapid it's going to be. I want like interactive games about all the different venomous snakes and how to tell them apart, especially ones that like live in the area. So a bit of like, oh, actually, if you go over to India and you're bitten by or if you see this snake, how can you tell it apart? Look at these patterns and stuff, and a little bit about them. It'd be really interesting if we had like an interactive model of a child and an adult and like how much venom it would take to kill them. So like,
let's traumatize the children.
No, but like, it'd be interesting, you know what I mean?
It'd be interesting to me.
And like interactive buttons so you can press and be like, oh, one king cobra. You'd be like, this king cobra could kill this man. Or it would take half a poison frog.
When I introduced natural selection garden,
you
were very negative about it. You were like, I'm not going to hear you out anymore. Because I said, whoever survives, survives. Whoever doesn't. And you're like, no, it's too dark. And now here you are.
Yeah, no, I'm on board. I am on board. To be fair, I think since we've seen that, we've seen a lot from the poison garden at Ulwick up north. Mm. I think they're a brilliant idea. I think in Planty Planty Zuzu, we might have to have tours through the natural selection garden.
I want it to be genuinely dangerous. Mm. So it's like going on a roller coaster, or like a sketchy roller coaster. It's a sketchy roller coaster in garden form.
Yes. Do we say it's also enclosed, isn't it? It's a biodome.
Yeah, I don't think we got that far, but yeah, it is now.
Yeah, it is, yeah. Less a biodome and more like a big greenhouse.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think that feels more authentic gardening feel. Mm. Rustic. But yeah, that's what we're doing. We're sticking interesting, venomous, poisonous, dangerous animal interp around a king cobra viv in the natural selection garden.
That sounds incredible. Can I make one extra suggestion?
Mm-hmm.
You know those TV shows like in the 90s and stuff, like Jungle Run?
Yes.
And you have to like run through and like do all these different tasks and stuff. What if we had big animatronic snakes and it was like some kind of game showy Jungle Runny type thing, but with snakes, and then you got to see how they really looked and the part of them, like, you know how you said the king cobra shoots up and forwards, that one would come at you like but then this one would come at you like, "Mah!" So you'd
that could be really funny, actually. Really, really, really cool.
Thank you. Something for you to consider. Mm. It's up to you. Put my pitch in.
No, I'm...
Also, I want a tram.
Amazing. I think that's us done.
Yeah. Nailed it.
Fantastic.
That was so much fun. It's been really great to like kick it all off again. I've really missed it because we do love doing the podcasting. So it's great to be back. And make sure you check us out on social media, on Instagram at Planty Planty Zuzu and Twitter at Planty Planty Zuzu.
And please do check out our website at plantyplantyzuzu.com.
Thank you very much for tuning in, and we'll catch you next time.
Bye.